Hello everyone. Welcome to the third podcast on technology commercialization from IEEE Young Professionals in collaboration with IEEE Entrepreneurship Society. Today we have Umar Zahar, CTO of Tandem Launch, as our guest. Thanks, Umar, for accepting our invite and joining us here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Before we get started into the podcast discussion, could you please explain what Tandem Launch is?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So Tandem Launch is a venture capital fund. Like any other, we want to invest in what is eventually going to become very successful, highly impactful tech companies. The difference is that we want to invest specifically in deep tech companies, companies that are commercializing scientific discovery, engineering discoveries, research that comes out of universities. And we decided when we started that the way we were going to do this was that rather than investing in companies that already exist, we were going to build them ourselves so that we could go out there, find the coolest technologies we could from universities around the world, and then concurrently look for individuals, deeply technical individuals with leadership traits or ambitions of leadership, who might not have their own ideas, but will come to us, join us, and then we'd work with them on commercializing these inventions that we'd found, each of them eventually becoming founders of the new businesses that we'd create. So that's essentially Tandem Launch in a nutshell.
Yeah, that sounds great. Basically, researcher or early technology professional doesn't have to worry about how it's getting into the product, learning new things. Actually, they can continue doing what they're doing and you're helping them get it into the market. That's actually a great concept in itself. And
yeah, I mean, one of the ways to think about it is just a way to transform what comes out of the research world into something that investors can accept and
yeah.
take as a company. And
yeah.
so, yeah.
Amazing, amazing, I must say. And why do a company or why do a startup? How do you decide if it's a right time for a researcher or a technology professional to do a startup?
So that's an interesting question. We have to ask this to ourselves all the time when we're looking at inventions that we're considering to invest in. And this is a big reduction, but you can largely categorize inventions into two main buckets. And the way you categorize them is to take the invention and then look at the world out there and identify whether or not the incumbent companies, the incumbent technology that people are using and are currently in commercial use, whether they use the same approach, the same technological ideas behind the invention. If the invention is an iterative improvement, something that optimizes, improves upon existing engineering approaches or technological or scientific approaches that are already in the market, then often we consider those technologies as better suited for directly licensing to large companies rather than building a startup. If, however, the invention solves some very large, valuable technical problem, but does it in a way that is not currently done in the market, it does it through, you know, new scientific insights, new ways of looking at the problem, requires technologies or platforms that aren't commonly supplied, then or they address markets that don't exist yet, like underserved markets that are created by the existing available
yeah.
technology. And in those cases, a startup is often not just the better choice, but the only choice to commercialize those inventions, because larger companies don't usually have the risk profiles to pick those up and commercialize them themselves.
So between these two buckets, licensing versus making a startup, which one is your favorite?
Well, definitely the company building. It's the one that gave me my job. yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm really interested in the path that technology takes to get commercialized in any context. But I think the coolest stories I've seen in my career are ones where a startup was necessary simply because the approach was just so unique and novel and the impact so large that you really just had to build this dream team of, you know, founders with different personalities, different mindsets, different expertise, and try and figure out how to put all these people together around this idea and solve all these really difficult problems along the way, mostly scientific.
Yeah.
So that's my favorite, just because the transformation you see in the process is just
It's very lively process, very lively, full of energy and enthusiasm.
Yeah, and you don't recognize the invention by the other side of it. You know, it looks like something usable and totally, you know. we have a company called SoundScript that's they're commercializing a new type of microphone design. And currently what SoundScript sells is a MEMS device that can be deployed into laptops, can be deployed into any kind of mobile device, and is purely directional. It can tell you where sound is coming from. So it's almost like a 3D microphone, if you will. And this is almost impossible to do with standard microphones, because you have to create a microphone array. So, you know, Alexa, in order to pick up where your voice is coming from, has to use an array of microphones. But when we picked up this technology, this, you know, novel science, it came out of a research lab, Binghamton University, the lab of Professor Ronald Miles. And he was prototyping this microphone between two massive electromagnets and a piece of spider silk that had been coated with conductive metals. So we went from spider silk microphone all the way to completely functional MEMS device that uses existing manufacturing practices. And that transformation is just mind-blowing. It doesn't make any sense when you look at it in retrospect, but somehow this group of really clever, ambitious people got there, and it's very cool to see.
Yeah, the story seems very inspiring. I agree with that. And how do you think researchers should balance scientific and business considerations in this process of commercialization? Just the very example of the microphones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that tension is interesting, because it's the tension itself that's important. You have to weave together a very important focus on product and your customers in order to get that product to market, to get adoption high, to make revenue. But you have to balance that with a divergent, explorative attitude towards new scientific achievements, because that's how you're going to keep your company growing and relevant. Often when we start commercializing these inventions, the final endpoint that they could achieve, the largest markets that they could enter, are not currently available unless they solve some serious R&D milestones, ones with large scientific uncertainties in them. And so if you ignore that pursuit, the research milestones that can unlock new markets, then at some point you might find yourself a single product company without a path forward to the next thing, to what the next step of growth is. And that can force you to make certain business decisions, which could be successful, but will pull you away from the unique competitive advantage that was imbued by your core technology over time.
That's a great way of putting it. And did you see any role shifting that researchers do, or maybe the technology professionals do in this process? Like someone who was doing scientific development, or maybe pure science, had to do a product development or product management, something like that? Or do you recommend that at all?
Yeah, so we hire what we call technical leads, people with PhD degrees from all walks of life, sometimes just graduated, sometimes graduated a few years ago, having worked in the industry. And they come into our program, and they start as this broad term technical lead, people that are responsible for driving the technology's development forward as we build the company. And what I notice is that different people tend to naturally have an affinity towards different parts of, let's say, the R to D spectrum, the research to development to product spectrum. Some of them are just the most clever researchers you'll ever find. And so they belong really, they'll tend to stay on the R side. They don't have the mindset for product development, because they tend to be more divergent in their mindset. They're explorers rather than focusers. And then there's others, and the vast majority of the people we hire that come out of academia, you know, are really naturally have an affinity there.
Yeah.
But every once in a while we get people who are one reason or another happen to be naturally gifted leaders, naturally gifted communicators. They are perhaps, you know, much better at talking to customers, extracting specifications, and therefore dictating how the product is going to be designed. And so those people might fall a little bit further away from the research side and end up closer to, you know, develop product management and the like. Where they fall it tends to be organic. So we give them space and guidance to end up where they naturally operate best. I wouldn't push it. I wouldn't push people out of their boxes. You know, like if they operate best in one place, then the solution to achieving what you need in those other places is to hire people that are suited to those, rather than trying to do it yourself. You have to fight that academic urge to do everything yourself when you're building a company.
What's with this explorer mindset, or maybe just looking at the products in itself, do you like the products to be multifunctional, or do you like the product should be just doing one job? Like, let's say if it is maybe an MRI for neonatal, or maybe a high resolution imaging for some box imaging, what do you think that the way it should be like? Should the technology also focus like a laser focus towards the final solution, or should it have a exploratory alternate pathway as they are commercializing towards the step?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because a lot of the time inventions solve broad technical problems that could address different market problems across many industries. And so the choice of where to go, I'd say it's both bottom up and top down. It's top down in that you look at market dynamics, you study market information, and you identify what the frictions of entry are going to look like based on the supply chain, what the capital expenditures are, how much money you need, what the regulatory environment looks like. Those are the sort of top-down conditions or constraints that'll help you filter at least what's unlikely to be possible where you are, given your ability to raise money, given the team you have, et cetera. And then there's a bottom-up for those markets that are left. You really need to go out and talk to people, because the way you're going to address those markets is going to depend a lot on the interaction between what your customers want across those markets and what your technology needs to become for each of those markets. If you don't need to change the culture of your engineering team, your sales team, in order to address multiple markets, then you might find a clever strategy that allows you to engage multiple markets with very little additional headcount or you know, cost, essentially, while using the same core platform. So, you know, for example, a lot of cloud service providers will provide the same cloud service or AI compute to both the medical industry or the legal industry or the consumer tech industry. So that same product, that same technology platform can address all those markets. And then a product in that instance is just how to represent that technology platform to those different customers. If you can get in that position, then that's a great place to be, because you can address all those markets at the same time, or one over another in parallel.
Yep. And are there any programs like in accelerators or incubators in itself at the early stage commercialization for engaging these markets or customers that you recommend?
I mean, there's been an explosion of resources for entrepreneurs or budding entrepreneurs that go all the way from early industry engagement, talking to customers, customer discovery type programs, such as the like I2I grant in the US, to all the way to complete company builders like ours, where you just show up as an aspiring entrepreneur, or you show up as an inventor, and then you get a company on the other side of it, and everything in between. And so the thing about those programs, though, is they tend to be quite regionally focused. And so we aren't regionally focused. Well, people from all over the world can come join us. We work with universities all over the world, but that's because we're a private fund that operates distinctly. If your company is already created, then you're unlikely to be, you know, going to an accelerator on the other side of the world. So if you already have a company and you're building it out and you're looking for kind of resources around you, that's usually a local exploration effort, identifying what it is that you need at that point and then who can give it to you. But my general opinion on these things is to look for the places that can get you connected to what you need most, whether that's resources or people, rather than the places that will teach you what to do next. We live in an age where information about how to build companies is just all over the place, and it's free. So the real value add is when you find that mentor that's done this before, or that industry contact that can champion you through the market. That's where the real gold is.
So when you're picking between different programs among the programs, is it safe to say that look for connections more than these educational resources if they're providing
Certainly,
connections?
certainly. Like as a broad rule, I would say yes. However, if you're a student who just has never thought about this, has never you have an invention in hand, you want a framework to follow as you figure out whether or not it can be commercialized, by all means, go to your university, see what kind of services your innovation office provides you. It tends to be free, and they also, in the course of sending you through these frameworks, you tend to build a network. Of people you can talk to and customers and the like. So, those kinds of endeavors, I think can be great as long as you do them once. You don't want to get addicted into that cycle of feeling comfortable in a framework that someone else is giving you, because at some point you just have to jump off that cliff and define your own path.
And can you please explain go-to-market strategy and the importance of having a business plan in the startup journey?
When you have an invention in hand, it's very easy to fall into the trap of having a solution looking for a problem. Though you do on some level need to not look for the problem, but extrapolate the problem, because an invention solves a technical problem, not a market problem. And there are many market problems, and some of them are driven by human issues. Some of them are driven by issues created by dynamics between companies or regulatory landscapes. But there is a subset of issues, market problems, that are technologically created, that they're due to qualities of the existing technologies that are used that create an underserved market or a current incapacity and a need as a result of that. And so deep tech companies are really well suited to addressing those market problems that are driven by underlying technical problems. So, first thing you need to do is figure out how your technical problem manifests itself in various markets. That's going to give you a sense of where you can make the most impact, and also how to segment your markets. Market segmentation is often a function of what you're trying to build and what you need to understand. So there's nothing fixed in stone, right? There's no objective list of market segments. It's very context-based, and so that'll help you understand how to segment your markets. And then before you start creating any kind of market entry strategy, you want to picture what it looks like if your company actually is at the end of this process. What happens if your technology dominates every market that it could help? What does it look like? How would that product be sold? How would you be making money? What does that look like at the end goal? And then only then can do you start working backwards, thinking about, okay, well, what order of markets would I have reasonably addressed in order to get to this final state? Which ones can be addressed now based on what's possible? Which ones will only be addressable later if I hypothetically solve these three R&D challenges that are yet to be unsolved? So I guess the three main concepts on this is to first picture the end goal, if everything works out, what all the possible addressable markets would be if everything worked out. And then based on the R&D trajectory that's required to get everything solved and the difficulty of each of those R&D milestones, how might you be able to order those valuable markets such that you can create an entry market strategy as well as a future market strategy for when you solve certain R&D goals? And that tension between R&D and market entry is constant in a deep tech company. So you might have to pivot, change directions simply based on the fact that you discover that a certain R&D milestone is a lot harder to solve than you thought. Maybe it's impossible to solve, and you need to be ready to branch into a different direction should that happen.
I agree with that. It's always, even I personally found that getting into the market, you look at your own solution working towards the industry side, but then there is a medical side where it can make difference as well, solving the deaths, reducing the number of deaths in some time. And then between that, the go-to-market strategy or is what it makes difference. Like with industry, you're there right in then, you can just go into the market now, whereas with medical things, there are like it takes long duration and stuff. And I also noticed that there are some regulatory hurdles that are there. What do these look like to you for the investors? Do you like the long journey of the medical landscape where you have to solve these step at a time? Or do you like the just why risk it, have an industry solution which is prompt and you get the returns very fast, ROI very fast?
Yeah, I'm sure most investors want to get ROI very fast. I'm sure most do. But there's other factors, right? There's the amount of I in that ROI. The amount of R in that ROI as well, you know? So, I mean, medical technologies can create billions of dollars of value. So often they're worth the wait. And so I think that the deciding factor for investors tends to actually be more operating expertise. Do they know how companies evolve in those industries? Do they know how to navigate those questions? Can they predict how certain things will go based on previous experience and data points? That I think is going to drive whether or not an investor likes or dislikes medical more than anything else. And it subdivides even further than that. So, I mean, Tandem Launch, we really, really, really mostly focus on consumer technology. And that's because that's where our network is. That's where the entrepreneurs that founded Tandem Launch build companies into, know how to build companies and know how to scale companies in. So we organically sort of developed a scope around that rather than, let's say, agricultural technology or industrial technologies. Even though we have built a few companies in those spaces, but mostly we focus in one place, and that's a result of where the experience is in the partnership.
Yeah. And what are the common challenges that you have faced in the startup navigation? While maybe it could be broad, so let's just focus on early stage commercialization process. What are the common challenges that you have seen with the researchers or the technology developers?
So very quickly, there's a few very critical challenges you have to face. The first is your team. You have to start hiring people that complement you. And when I say complement, I don't mean that are the same as you, but really that are different. Very soon, especially on the product development side. If you really want to start thinking about engaging customers and how the language of customers translates into requirements for your technology, you need someone who is interested, engaged, and capable of being a product manager for your technology. That is unlikely to be the inventor. The mindset, the culture of the academic world is not conducive to what is needed for product management. So that's typically the first very difficult thing you have to do, because they're not easy to find. They're not going to be in your department. You're probably going to have to look at other departments. And also it helps if they've had some industry experience. Actually, it helps a lot if they have some experience in the industry doing some of this product management works. They can bring those ideas to the table. Product management is not the kind of knowledge base that you can purely learn, academically or theoretically. It's something
from
that you really have to
do. Educational resources.
So already hiring is really a very difficult challenge. Funding can be difficult or not difficult depending on what resources you have around you. Sometimes you can piggyback on certain academic industrial grants and such. So funding can be actually rather straightforward in that context. And then after that, it becomes a matter of really disciplining yourself.
Yeah.
Separating yourself from the solution so that you can really start embodying someone who's pursuing the problem you want to solve. Because often,
do we not need to fall in love with our solution to work better at it?
So, good question. I think that it's a hazard more than anything. Because falling in love with your solution means committing to how you imagined how your technology currently works and how you imagine it's supposed to work into the future. And the problem with doing that is that you're doing it in the absence of asking anyone that's going to be paying money for this. The best way to solve the problem might not be your solution. At some point, it might be now and it might not be later, or it might be some modification or heavily reduced version of your solution. It might be a version of it that's hobbled so that it can be adopted more readily or integrated into the industry more readily. Who knows? But if you fall in love with the solution and not the problem, then then you're at risk of not making the necessary decisions to prioritize the growth and success of your company.
Okay. And
at the end of the day, it's what the customers buy. Customers buy solutions to their problems. Yeah. They don't care about your solution unless it solves their problem.
I get that. So, and falling in love with problem is essentially a thing. Falling in love with motivation, where you're coming from while developing the solution. And does that mean that if we are falling in love with problem, we are working more towards a social purpose venture?
Well, no, when I say problem here, I really do mean the customer problem, the market problem.
Market problem.
Falling in love with solving that issue, right?
Okay.
So that your methodology for solving that issue, let's say neonatal ultrasound, your potential version of an ultrasound scanner might not be what that industry needs. The maybe some of the core concepts of your research are what matter, but some of the other ones that you thought were important don't matter at all, and you're going to have the discipline to get rid of them and to drop them and to stop trying to sell them. And that's very, very hard for people that have invented these things.
I get that. I agree. It makes sense now. And how do you think that startup builders or founders should measure the metrics of success for technology commercialization? What are the metrics that they should be using?
Yeah, so primarily I would say money is the way to decide whether or not your company is successful.
Very honest.
You need to make money. Nothing beats revenue. And I think that's and yes, I can say that letters of interest or people subscribing to something for free or what have you can all be early indications of traction, of the fact that you're onto something. But it's people telling you that your technology is cool for free is very easy to do. People willing to put down money in order to tell you that your technology is cool, much harder to do. And there really nothing really replaces that, because that is the only real way that consumers say that what you have has value. Now, of course, I'm talking about your traditional sort of product selling startup. You can extrapolate this to, you know, a B2B licensing where, you know, you're selling some new chip designs to a big OEM or something, that then their, you know, interest is the kind of partnerships you build and contracts you sign with them, and eventually the royalty deals and such, and eventually it becomes revenue. But there's a lot of signals along the way before that. Of course, you've got your social impact startups, which, you know, aren't profit driven at all. In that case, I would say, you know, they need to create a KPI that defines their success. Is it number of hungry children fed? Is it number of the reduction in people getting a certain disease? Is it, you know, what is the metric that you stand for? And then, yes, then it's a matter of measuring by that metric. But if you're a for-profit business selling a product, then, you know, the sort of universally accepted metric for that is revenue.
Revenue.
And I would say also for investors, if you're looking for investment, it would be the rate of revenue, right? A revenue growth over time. That's important to investors. They want to understand how your value is going to grow over time, and whether or not it's, and where it's going to cap out, where you're going to saturate, where you're not expected to grow any further. Yeah. So those things are also, of course, metrics of success.
Metrics of success. So founders, keep and watch for this. It's not the results that you're getting or the publications that you're looking for or the software packages you're building. The metrics change. So I think you have to keep in mind what Omar is saying here. And
so that's a really fun point, actually. That's a really interesting point, because it's part of what comes down to the diversity of the people you hire. This is why I love seeing inventors become technology leaders. I'm not a huge fan of inventors becoming CEOs or taking on roles that operate by metrics that they are not accustomed to operating by. A technology leader operates by the success metric of scientific discovery, technical discovery, right?
Yeah.
And that is embodied as paper publications and you know, high quality research is highly impactful journals, etc. But so there is a system for measuring research success that they have been operating in for a very long time. To put them then in a chair that expects them to operate on a metric that they're not used to operating on, let's say revenue or money into the business, that is a really big jump to make. And so some of them are end up being natural at it and good for them and go for it. But most people will not be naturals at it. And in those cases, I have huge respect for founders that you know, say, hey, I need to hire myself a CEO, or I need to hire myself an expert that understands those metrics and can drive decision-making on that side.
Yeah, well explained. I agree with that too. So just extrapolating the technology leaders part. So do you think that these technology leaders are maybe CTOs or CSOs in that sense? Can they be that?
Oh yeah, titles at that point. I don't get too hung up on titles, but yes, leading. So the reason I don't get hung up on titles is that being a chief science officer or a chief anything officer is not about being an expert in the domain, the knowledge domain that's represented by the middle letter. It's about the chief and officer part. So the chief implies that you are, you know, one of the highest representations of leadership in that business. That means that, you know, you're not spending your time entirely alone, individually contributing to on a lab bench. You're spending most of your time coordinating individuals, managing humans, understanding the long-term strategies and necessities of the business. And then the O part, you're an officer of the company, which means that your highest concern should be the well-being of the entire business. And so those two letters on the edges are much more important than the letter in the middle.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But there are many, many opportunities for leadership across the spectrum of that, you know, hierarchy of companies. And when you're a startup, that difference, that delta is really not that big. Yeah. But leadership at those higher levels is not about research leadership. It's about, yeah, let's again back to the conversation of metrics. The metrics of success of being a CRO is not how good of a researcher you are. It's as good of a research leader you are. A very different question.
Yeah. And I see that the companies have advisory boards, a lot of directors, and stuff like that. How important is this to have a panel as such?
Absolutely critical. Part of what will decide how much success your business has is how well you can leverage the ecosystem around you. And what do I mean by ecosystem? I mean the industry, obviously, they're probably going to be your customers. But I also mean government, the subsidies that they provide, access to various resources and the like, the regulations and policies that will then, you know, affect your markets. And then there's the investor ecosystem. And then there's you trying to navigate all of that. And then, of course, there's the academic ecosystem. Advisors are experts or windows into each of those ecosystems, often ecosystem players that are relevant to your business. You know, we built a materials company that was developing novel surface coating technologies. And so we were very lucky to have someone who used to be an executive at 3M join the technical advisory board there, right? And what they were bringing to the table wasn't research expertise. They were telling us what's going to work and what doesn't work in this industrial sort of domain that we've decided to pursue. What are they going to allow on their machines? What are they absolutely not going to allow on those machines? What sort of things should we consider that would never really touch the academic environment? A lot of the times, for example, you have, let's say, inventions in semiconductor out of research labs are often built using electron beam lithography, for example. Prototypes are often made with that. In the industry, you can't use the e-beam. It's not scalable enough. And so anytime we start to wade into the semiconductor world, first thing we go is we need an industry expert here, and we're going to need them on an advisory board because the challenges here are not going to be about the research. Of course, there's going to be research challenges, but the largest uncertainties, the things that can really kill the company, are the kinds of things you'd only know if you're a domain expert. And you can take that again to our medical example, right? Not having someone who is an expert in navigating FDA regulation for the kind of technology that you're pursuing, either in your company or on your advisory board, feels like a very quick way to get yourself killed.
Good. And just around the point that you're saying getting yourself killed, so is it good to have an exit plan? If yes, an early exit plan, or how late it should be?
Yeah, I mean I think personally to an entrepreneur, it's good to know what your end goal is. Do you want to build this company and run it forever? Do you want it to be acquired? Do you want to, make a large amount of money in a short amount of time? Are you going to be accepting other investors? If you're alone, you can decide whatever exit plan you like. But if you're taking investor money, then you have to think about their exit too. An exit in this case being, how are they going to get their money back? How are they going to get, liquidity? And so, yes, I mean, the short answer is yes, it's absolutely critical. And this is often when investors ask you for your business model, they also want to know how your business exits. What are the likely acquisition targets for your business? Or is there a likely path to an IPO here, et cetera? Does your business model support one of those two things? Does the technology support one of those two things, et cetera?
Let me be a bit selfish here and look at the academic perspective for the same exit strategy. Academic environment has a lot of accelerators, has a lot of support from the innovation or tech transfer offices, commercialization support, and stuff like that, which kind of help you build a bit of early stage traction to a certain stage. So let's say if someone is kind of trying to make it on their own with the academic grants or fundings itself for a bit of time, and then instead of investing, getting investors on board or pitching it across, maybe try to have some company or maybe some organization like yours acquire it or take it forward so that the researchers can go back and make some new technology. So what do you think that looks like? Is that even a successful thing at all for the researchers?
Well, so absolutely. I mean, so every one of our researchers, more or less, every one of our researchers stayed researchers, right? We built companies based on their inventions. They collaborated with us as researchers. They joined the technical advisory board. Maybe we did some joint collaboration on R&D projects. We joint publishing, sponsored research, all sorts of stuff, but they stayed researchers. They did not become full-time employees in our companies. They wanted to remain professors or academic professionals. So it's completely appropriate to find a way for your idea, your project to commercialize itself under the leadership of somebody else. That's normal. What is much harder to do is to pass on your company to somebody else. If your intention is not to found and run the company, then don't found
Don't
and
make it
run the company.
traction.
No, don't, well, don't start, right? So what you would do is, oh, sure, you can use these programs to perhaps create a business idea, talk to customers, get some information. But at that point, you find a partner, you find someone who will take the commercialization side of this, and you can go back to the academia or be a collaborating researcher or what have you. But yeah, I would say that if you're already committed to building the company, it's a little late to talk about exiting that company and passing it on. Now, again, definition of company here can be a little weak too, right? So if you're just one person and some research and some proof of concepts, passing on a company is fine, right? You're just finding founders. But certainly,
If the market engagement is done or the customer engagement, customers are already explored or stuff like that, and there is a team of researchers or something like, usually I think in academia it's more like there's a research group working on one particular thing. So I would imagine it would look like a group of them, maybe a few of them as inventors, a few of them as contributors make a patent, and after that they kind of apply for some grants or proof of concept funding or all that sort of thing to build it a bit further. And can they come and reach out to you at that stage and
Oh,
initiate a
absolutely.
discussion? Would you love that
That
somehow?
stage or even before, anytime. Researchers can always come to us with their work and say, hey, what do you think of this? Do you think this could be a business? And we will build the team together if we think it could be and build a company out of it in collaboration with them. But that's typically as far as they'll go, right? They will not be coming in as founders that'll leave later. Also, investors don't want that because there's so much more to building the company than the things that you do on a day-to-day basis. It's the the passion you bring, the drive, the history that you bring, that you store in your head. When a founder who has been with the company from the beginning leaves, that is a potentially existentially threatening moment. You don't want that to happen too many times or at all.
And do you also support tech professionals who are working in industries and have ideas or maybe have patents of their own work?
Well, not us specifically. We really, really want to focus on the strength, the power, the ingenuity behind academic research. Years and years and years goes into this, you know, that those discoveries, and for them to be sitting on a shelf, rotting away is just a tragedy. We really want to focus on those. IP generated by industry also tends to be quite domain specific, market specific, specific to the markets of that company, which would make it risky as an investment for us, because we like to have also some options when it comes to the markets that we can address with the technology.
Okay. And the last but one question, this would be, so what are the industries that you focus on for the interested listeners to come and talk to you? Do you have any specific industries in mind?
Yeah, you know, I would say any technology that touches a consumer, either directly or indirectly, anything that goes into your iPhone, anything that drives your smart homes, artificial intelligence, computer vision, really all of it. We like to keep our potential net wide because we never really know the impact of what a technology is going to have until we look at a specific invention, you know. So we keep our view rather wide, but it's typically stuff that will be touching on consumers somehow. So that's usually what it looks like. Physical sciences, engineering, that sort of thing.
And the last question, what advice would you give for the engineering researchers or science entrepreneurs who are trying to make some new inventions out there? What's your advice?
If you want to build a company, just be really, really sure you want to build a company before you do it. If you're interested in invention, and you're at the early starts of your academic career, be very intentional with the research area you join, the professor or supervisor you join. Work backwards from your goal, right? Look at the research that's going on at the university that you think does lend itself to something really exciting being developed, and then work within that system to become the inventor you want to become. Universities are awesome for that, because if you go in with intention at the start, there's so many different kinds of research going on across so many different domains. And there's a lot of flexibility, I typically see, at least a lot of flexibility on the supervisor side of what, how to take that research core and to move in a certain direction. And so you can almost design this really cool experience of sort of where you want to work, what you want to work on, and what you're going to create in the process. And if you've got dreams of being an entrepreneur from the very start, and you're lucky enough to know that you want to be an entrepreneur when you first start college, then you can design that entire academic trajectory to put you in front of a technology that you think is commercially viable. I know people blessed with that kind of foresight that started building companies while they were PhD students, while they were master's students, still managed to graduate on time, publish a thesis and build a company. So it can happen.
Stories where they quit their degrees.
Equally accessible. I think that, so if what you're building, if the company that you're building really does not connect to the research that you're doing, then yes, you know, it's more of being split across two jobs.
Yeah.
But if you play your cards right, the research that you're doing can be the R&D efforts that drive your business.
Yeah.
Because in a deep tech company, you are still doing work that has massive scientific uncertainty and academic value. It's just more applied. And so you could very much have your PhD packaged within the very company that you're building.
It's important to have a right team, I guess.
Well, it's going to differ. I don't like giving broad advice for people on this subject because it really depends on the individual. But one piece of very broad advice I can give is don't start building a company if you aren't absolutely ready to become a
Do it.
founder full time.
Yeah. Just be sure, guys, if you want to do it, if you really want to do it, just go and pursue it. Otherwise, there are a lot of other options, right from starting from licensing to just reaching out to foundries, like what Omer Zahar is talking about, the tandem launch. There are so many options right there in the market, so which you could explore. Right, that's our time. Thank you so much, Omer, for being very patient. And we did go a bit over time today, but you have been very kind explaining the stuff there. And
Oh, it's a complete
I would,
pleasure.
it was genuinely an honor to have you here today. And we are hoping to have more from you going forward as well. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Noor.
Thank you.